Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Kimberly Castor, registration number 31606. I represent Mr. Ricky Wong in this case, the appellant and defendant who is on direct appeal challenging his substantive convictions below. Just as a preliminary matter, I'd really like to take an opportunity to thank the Court for allowing me to file an extended reply brief in this case and consider a little bit more of a lengthy argument on this. I know that's not standard practice for you all, and I really appreciate the opportunity to really delve into some of these subject matters as I needed to respond to the district attorney in this case. So thank you very much for that opportunity and the willingness to consider these arguments as they are of grave importance to my client. Your Honor, I think what is most important in this case is that this is kind of a textbook example of why a criminal defendant has an appeal of right in the state of Colorado under our Constitution as well as the federal Constitution. Throughout the entire trial process, from the time my client was arrested until today's date, his appeal and his trial were wrought with incredible amounts of prejudice, unfair proceedings, and violations of due process. And this is one of those classic examples that we really need to take a very close detailed look at the proceedings that went on. They were complex, they took a long time, and I appreciate your willingness to go through and look at all of those details as I put pointed forth in the opening and reply briefs and look at that record, because it is critical in this case. So there are three main issues that really pop out. There's the right to a speedy appeal in this case. There is whether or not the co-defendant should have been severed. And then there's whether or not my defendant as well as the co-defendant should have been shackled during the trial. Each one of those are wrought with prejudice, both inherent and imputed prejudice that really has shifted the burden to the people in this case to prove that that whatever prejudice exists was harmless error or that it didn't really impact the outcome of the trial. And in this case, I would say in all three matters, the prejudice is so unfair that it presumes that this proceeding was unfair. Let me go ahead and start with the severance issue, because I think it's kind of the most compelling argument here and is one of the kind of a textbook example of why we have the severance issue and the option to sever defendants, even when there is an alleged conspiracy case. In this case, I would argue that the court failed to really engage and uphold its duty of discretion in determining whether or not there was a conspiracy. When it considered all of the evidence, my client was not implicated. The only evidence that existed were co-conspirator statements, which are by law discreditable, and there was no corroborating evidence that put my client at the scene of the crime or anywhere connected, knowingly or otherwise, to the crime. So because the court failed to properly establish a conspiracy, it was inappropriate to try my client with the co-defendant.
Ms. Castor, you mentioned conspiracy, but there was also a complicity theory, was there not?
Yes, there was.
And the complicity doesn't require the court to make any independent determination that there was a conspiracy, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that is a question for the jury.
Okay, yes. So under those circumstances, doesn't the prosecution then have the obligation and as well as the right to prove the facts of the crime itself and try and connect your client in this case to the crime?
Absolutely. So we can look at it in two ways. The conspiracy theory is kind of the front end argument, and the complicitor theory is kind of the back end of the argument. And so if we look at it from both directions, when you look at the evidence before the trial took place and after the trial took place, neither way could the prosecution prove that my client was connected to the crime.
And what about the vehicle being registered to your client and the driving from California?
He didn't drive the vehicle from California. It was merely registered to him. That was it.
But the vehicle was driven from California, wasn't it?
But it wasn't by my client. And there isn't any allegations that he knew about it or that he was involved. All of the testimony actually shifted all of the knowledge to an alternate suspect in this case. And so the only thing was that there was a registration form that connected that car to my client, which is probably not sufficient.
I'm confused. It sounds like you're making a sufficiency of the evidence argument, which is not in your briefs.
What I'm trying to talk about here is we are getting a little derailed. What I really want to talk about is that there probably is a sufficiency of the evidence argument, but what I really wanted to focus on in this case, because I felt it was a stronger argument, was the concept of severance. And that because of the amount of evidence and because of the kind of nature of evidence, so we kind of have to get into a little bit of a sufficiency of the evidence, but not really, because of the nature of the evidence, my client was entitled to summons as a matter of right.
Well, under the complicity theory, though, the prosecution, as Judge Casebolt pointed out, has an obligation and a right to prove the crimes as to which he is charged as a complicit. So all the evidence relating to what happened in the house is admissible against your client, is it not?
No, it is absolutely not.
How is that? He's charged as a complicit.
Because there wasn't anything that connected him to the crime. Even in complicit theory, you still have to have knowledge. You have to have some kind of an action to support and be a part of the crime.
But you have not alleged insufficiency of the evidence in your briefs. That's a new claim I'm hearing for the first time today. Are you saying that the evidence is insufficient as a matter of law to support the convictions? And if so, that's just not in your briefs.
What I am arguing is that either way, what I really want to stick to is the severance matter. And we can look at a sufficiency of the evidence, but really that derails us, because those two issues are kind of intermingled a little bit. And when we look at whether or not you're going to sever a case, and whether or not it was error for the trial court to grant a motion for severance, and that motion was made all throughout the case, even at the close of the evidence. So we had the opportunity to evaluate all of the evidence throughout the case. And when you look at whether or not a case should be severed, you not necessarily have to look at the quantum of evidence. You have to look at whether or not it's prejudicial and whether or not it is admissible against the other defendant. And in this case, they were going on a conspiracy theory. They did go on a complicit theory, but they used both. And so they started out the case that way. If you look at the pretrial motions on the March 28th hearing, that's exactly how the judge set it up. And that's why the judge denied the motion for severance, because they found a conspiracy. And so what I would say is the judge made an error there. And throughout the case, she kept shifting her theory and kept shifting it around. She expressed a lot of concern about why my client was being tried with these other people for time matters, for speedy trial issues, for the nature of the evidence that was going to be admitted, for the alleged co-conspirator statements that were going to be admitted. So she was very concerned about why my guy was being tried with all of these others. But what it came down to, she followed the classic case of the nature of the crime, the number of people, whether or not the evidence would be prejudicial, the necessity of judicial economy, and all of the reasons that she hung her reasoning on were perfunctory. Because quite frankly, there were other defendants that were going to have to be tried in another case, in a separate proceeding, that were still connected to the same case that happened to be arrested later. So the whole concept of judicial economy fell. The whole concept of protecting the witnesses from having to testify again fell. The whole concept of the same evidence and preserving evidence fell. And whether or not the defendant would earn some kind of a benefit from being tried later, when in actuality, it was the prosecution that gain the benefits from being able, knowing that they were going to have a second trial, at the time that all of these hearings were being presented, at the time they were making these arguments as to why this case shouldn't be severed, they knew they were going to have the benefit of two bites at the apple on trying this case. They were going to get to try it here, and then they were going to get to try it in a few months when they had Mr. Wong, I believe, who was tried later. So what happened here is the court shifted her.
But I'm confused. I mean, it's almost as if you're saying, well, they should have been allowed to try it four times because they all should have been severed.
Yeah, absolutely. They should have been
severed. All right, so you're saying it's improper for them to have the benefit of being able to try it twice but it's not improper for them to have the benefit of trying it four times?
No, what I'm saying here is what their argument in their brief, I'm just kind of contradicting what their reasons were for why they should not have severed the case. And one of the biggest arguments that the trial court and the prosecution rely on was their fear of the defendants gaining some kind of benefit from being tried multiple times. But in actuality, what happened here is the prosecution gained a benefit. So what I'm just doing is contradicting the reasons that the trial court hung their hat on for not severing the case. And I would argue that it should have been severed as a matter of right, and it should have been severed as a matter of discretion. And she failed to exercise her discretion in this case and overlooked the overwhelming amount of evidence that was brought in against Mr. Lamb. Compared to the amount of evidence that was brought in against my client, he hardly participated in the trial because there was nothing to object to, there was nothing to participate in, because it simply did not implicate him in the crime. And so when you have such a disparate amount of evidence, under discretion, the case should have been severed. And she knew exactly what the case was looking like before at the beginning of this trial.
I'm confused. How does the evidence as to what occurred in the house not implicate your client? The prosecution had to prove what happened in the house to convict your client.
Because there was no connection. You still have to have that connection.
Well, there's no sufficiency of the evidence claim on appeal, counsel. I mean, that boat sailed.
Well, but even when you're evaluating the evidence, you still have to determine whether or not a conspiracy existed and whether or not severance was appropriate. So in actuality, that argument is still preserved under that theory that when you're evaluating severance, you still have to evaluate the nature of the evidence, because we're talking about prejudice here. And we're talking about, you have to look at the quantum of evidence. You have to look at the evidence and determine whether or not it's prejudicial to the defendant. And so that's the test. And so when we have that kind of a test where we're already evaluating the nature of the evidence, a sufficiency of the evidence claim, yes, it might be appropriate, you might be right, but while it might be, I tend to go with a little bit stronger argument of severance, because had they not made those trial errors, my client would have gotten a fair trial. So that's what is the bottom line here, is that if my client was severed, the prosecution would have had an entirely different burden, an entirely different approach to the case, and would have had to surmount a much higher level of burden to be able to introduce any of that evidence, including the evidence in the house.
So then it seems to me the objection should have been that at trial, should have been this evidence, objection, Your Honor, this evidence is not admissible against my client. And then if that were denied, you'd be appealing that, but you're not appealing any of that. I mean, on appeal, we don't have a claim that any of the evidence was not admissible against your client. We don't have a claim that the evidence was insufficient to convict your client. And now you're coming up here and arguing today for the first time, as I can tell, that the court should have considered these things, presumably midway through trial, I guess, when it evaluates the evidence. It seems like you're trying to, I don't know, just, you know, put everything in this severance basket when it belongs maybe in different baskets.
I very respectfully disagree, Your Honor. While the matter of severance was paramount in this case, I think what everybody, even what Judge Casebolt has said in the Montoya case, when we look at the factors to be weighed, you necessarily have to look at who the defendants are, what the evidence is, and whether or not it's prejudicial to a client, so and prejudicial to a co-defendant, and whether or not it would be admissible. So by the very nature of that test, I'm not bringing in a sufficiency of the argument claim. I'm bringing in an evaluation under the Montoya case and whether or not severance was proper as a matter of right and even as a matter of discretion. So there is an evaluation of the evidence, and the court did engage in that in their March 28th hearing, where they looked at all of the evidence. She looked through all of the different proposed testimony, and even as the trial proceeded, it still continued to veer off in a different direction that even supported more of a reason for severing the case.
Well, you know, what you characterize as a different direction seems to me to be just different roles. I mean, he's the getaway driver. bank robbery, you have a getaway driver. Well, guess what? The evidence of what happens in the bank is admissible against the getaway driver.
There wasn't any evidence that he was the getaway driver.
Well, then where's your sufficiency of the evidence claim? Where is it? It's not here.
My point is, Your Honor, is that, okay, we have to pick and choose what arguments we're going to bring here. And what I am trying to do is limit, this is a very complex, long case. There were three main issues that I thought were absolutely necessary for overturning his convictions. And in this particular case, I believe severance was the most important way to evaluate how the case should have proceeded and what happened to my client versus how all the other evidence came in. And what happened to my client was he was railroaded. He was stuck in with this guy inappropriately against his constitutional rights to a fair trial. And you can look at all the evidence as one of the reasons. But you can also look at the fact that he was, that he objected timely several times, and that he also refused to waive his right to a speedy trial. So there are several ways we can look at why severance was absolutely mandatory in this case. And based on those arguments, Your Honor, as well as the arguments I preserved in my brief, I ask that you would reverse his convictions. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Emmy Langley, registration number 39075, and I represent the people in this matter. This case involves a horrific home invasion orchestrated by the defendant and five other men, during which some of the men duct taped the arms of the family members inside the home and threatened to cut off the hand of a girl who was already disabled in order to obtain the family's life savings. The defendant presents three claims on appeal: that he was denied a speedy and meaningful appeal, that the trial court should have severed the defendant's trial from the co-defendants, and that the trial court reversibly erred by forcing him to wear shackles during trial. All of these claims fail because, in the very least, he's failed to establish prejudice. I'm prepared to address all issues, but I'll turn to the second issue first. The trial court did not err in denying to sever the defendant's trial from Lamb's. The Supreme Court has recognized that joint trials play a vital role in the criminal justice system. Defendant argues he's entitled to severance as a matter of right and that the court abused its discretion in denying severance. The court here found good cause to sever because of the nature of the offense, the victims having to testify more than once, the complexity of the case, judicial economy, experts having to testify an extra time, risk of inconsistent verdicts, and because having multiple trials could inure to the benefit of the defendant who is tried later.
Ms. Langley, can we focus on the argument that opposing counsel makes that there's no evidence connecting Mr. Huang to the crime? Could you elucidate your view of that for us, please?
I respectfully disagree. Fong, one of the co-conspirators, testified that the defendant paid for the hotel room for the men to stay in. He talked to the men about the burglary ahead of time, including how to get into the house, and told them that the house belonged to Tu Sheng, one of the other co-conspirators' relatives. He told them to tie up the people in the house and to bring weapons in the house. And he was the man who provided the radios that were used during the burglary, and he took them the morning before the burglary to scope out the house. And he was also the person who commanded Fong into the house after the other three men were having trouble finding the money. And I think very importantly, Fong also testified that he was the person who divided the money at the end. So the prosecution did make a case that the defendant was actually the shot caller of the burglary.
The argument also, I think, is that the trial court erred in not making some findings concerning the adequacy of the prosecution's evidence concerning a conspiracy theory. And that sounds more like a legal argument that the court should have made some more findings that it didn't make. What's your view on that?
Well, I think that's a sufficiency of the evidence claim, which wasn't raised on appeal. But I do think the court made findings as to, I do not recall whether they made findings on the adequacy of the connection, but I mean, they did have a hearing on the severance, and the court did hear testimony from argument from defense counsel, and listed many reasons why there was good cause not to sever. Okay. The first issue I'll address next. The defendant was not deprived the right to speedy and meaningful appeal. I just want to point out quickly, as the court probably has already noticed, defense counsel is asserting because appellate counsel was not trial counsel that there should be a dual standard, and I just want to point out that that has been overruled by our Supreme Court, the People v. Salva case, as well as the cases of Kilpak and Anderson.
Well, on the issue of these bench conferences, mm-hmm. there seems to be a pretty big discrepancy here between what the defendant contends that there were over 50 of these, and the trial court found there were two or three. As I understand this record, it seems like the court was saying that if there were these other conferences, they were just off the record, and if, since they're off the record, they can't be, and indeed shouldn't be, I suppose, reconstructed. Is that accurate? Is that where the discrepancy is? Is there any real discrepancy that they met 50 times at the bench?
Well, I do think that there were a lot of bench conferences, and some of them were off the record, but as you point out, I think that some of them may have been purposely left off the record or just not requested to be recorded. And I think the main point is that the defendant doesn't have a specific claim as to what happened during the bench conferences that would have, you know, prejudiced him in any way.
Did trial counsel testify at all or participate at all in the proceedings to recreate the record?
I don't think the trial counsel testified, if I recall correctly, but there was some during the second reconstruction hearing. The Lamb's attorney, I think, said that she was going to talk to the trial counsel for Lamb and get back to the court if there was any discrepancy in the record, and I don't think that ever happened. If there's no more questions, I'd like to address the third issue. The defendant claims that the court did not exercise its discretion in finding that the defendants should be shackled, and I disagree. I think that what the court did was to talk to the sheriffs, and based on the conversation with the sheriffs, decided to shackle them. And in any event, the defendant can't show prejudice because the shackles were not visible, and the court made a subsequent finding that it could not hear or see the shackles.
The court indicated, or the court simply said, as I recall the record, said, I'm going to defer to what the deputies tell me. Is that accurate or not?
I think that originally the court said, or the prosecution asked the court to talk to the deputies, and I believe the court went, and from the record you can infer that the court did in fact talk to them about it and then made the decision subsequent to that to shackle them.
Well, is the deferral to the deputies a sufficient finding justifying the shackling?
I think so. I think because the conversation took place, and based on that conversation, the court decided to agree with the deputies as far as the reasoning for shackling them, then I think that is sufficient. But in any event, since the shackles were not visible, then I don't think that the defendant can show prejudice.
We have a finding here, it seems to me, that by the court that the shackles weren't visible to the court. Now, was there a finding that the shackles weren't visible to the jurors?
I think that the finding was that the court could not see the shackles, and defense counsel for Lamb did say before trial, I'm reading from the record on April 3rd, 2006, that assuming he doesn't have to get up or anything, the jury will not be able to see those being the shackles. So I do think that there was evidence on the record that they were referring to the jury. And neither defense counsel actually asserted that the shackles were visible by the jury, I don't think that they can demonstrate prejudice.
There's a discrepancy in the briefs as to the kind of shackles. There's a reference to wrist shackles in the defendant's brief, but in the record I only saw references to ankle shackles. Is the record clear on that?
I believe that there were only ankle shackles, and the judge, if I recall correctly, made a decision to use the shackles that were less likely to be seen by the jury. I think they were looking at a belt shackle, and the trial judge said, we're going to not use that because the jury is more likely to notice that. If there are no further questions, I ask that you affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. As soon as counsel.